It's been 7 weeks since a local branch of Russia's Federal Penitentiary Service published a brief news post about the death of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. He went for a walk, he felt sick, he collapsed unconscious, and couldn't be resuscitated. Russian officials would later insist that Navalny died of natural causes. His mother was told that he succumbed to sudden death syndrome. In mid-March, while celebrating a claim on a fifth presidential term, Vladimir Putin finally uttered Navalny's name in public aloud. But it was only to dance on his grave, claiming that he had been ready to trade off Navalny to the West, provided he never came back. But unfortunately, what happened happened. What can you do? That's life, said Putin. This week, we're going to look back at Navalny's career in politics by speaking to two of the people most responsible for educating the English-speaking world about his work. Canadian filmmaker Daniel Roher, whose documentary on Navalny won an Oscar last year, and journalist Julia Yoffe, who was one of the first Western reporters to write about Navalny and who's tracked him and his wife, Yulia Navalnaya, in numerous articles for more than a decade. Welcome to The Naked Pravda. Howdy, folks. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, managing editor of Medusa's English Language Edition. This week, we're looking back at Alexei Navalny's political career, which has been documented in countless news reports, articles, books for more than a decade. But the final chapter of his activism, particularly the investigation into his own poisoning in 2020, that's captured best and most dramatically, most intimately, in Daniel Roher's award-winning 2022 documentary film. It has a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. It won an Oscar. It's very good, folks. Daniel was kind enough to come on this podcast to talk about his work with Navalny and the making of the film. Could you just explain for listeners, because this wasn't totally clear to me from the film itself, when did you actually get involved with the Navalny campaign?
When you say the campaign, what you're speaking to is like Navalny's world.
Yeah, the team, right? Team Navalny, I guess, yeah.
Team Navalny, okay. So what I got involved with Navalny on November 14th, I want to say 2020. I was working on another film project. This has been well documented. And Christo Grozev and I, and one of the film's producers of Desiree, we were in Ukraine working on a story. You remember a few years ago, the Wagner Group, the Ukrainian Special Forces, they hatched this secret sort of Mossad-like plan to apprehend the worst Wagner guys they could get their hands on via this very elaborate scheme that they set up.
In Belarus, right?
In Belarus, yeah. And so Christo, we were sort of working on exposing that story 2 years before it broke. And it became clear that the sort of like antagonist of that story at that time was the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, and his administration. And like, were they in on it? Were they not in on it? And that was sort of the conceit of the movie we were making. And so we were in Ukraine. It became clear that government did not want us to tell that story. And so we were very assertively encouraged to leave Ukraine as quickly as possible. And
a quick refresher on that time, Belarusian special forces arrested 33 Wagner Group mercenaries on suspicion of plotting to destabilize the country during the election campaign, supposedly in league with the anti-Lukashenko opposition. All of the Wagner Group contractors, except for one Belarusian national, were returned to Russia after a couple of weeks, but not before the Ukrainian government attempted to convince Minsk to extradite the men to Ukraine to be prosecuted for fighting in the Donbass on the separatist side. Ukrainian journalists later reported that the Wagner Group trip through Belarus was itself part of an elaborate special operation by Ukraine's intelligence community that ultimately failed when Zelensky's office delayed at a crucial stage, and his administration then allegedly leaked information about the operation. According to researchers at Bellingcat, Ukraine even planned to force the landing of the plane carrying the Wagner mercenaries as it flew from Minsk to Istanbul by calling in a bomb threat as the airplane was entering Ukrainian airspace. The Ukrainian government denies all these allegations.
It's the middle of COVID. I was sitting in Vienna. I didn't have a film to make. You know, I had a girlfriend in Toronto where I'm from who's threatening to break up with me. My life was falling apart when Christo came in one morning and said, "What about that Navalny guy? I think I might have a lead into who tried to poison him." And immediately I was like, yes, Christo, let's go make that movie. You think you can get us in there? And he was like, well, I can ask. And Christo did. Christo Grozev is quite plausibly the only human being in the world who could have reached out to Alexei and said, I have a lead into who tried to poison you. And Navalny, knowing Christo and his work, would pay attention to that. So, you know, coasting very much on the pedigree of Grozev, we, you know, he's able to call Alexei and Maria Pevchik. This is probably like November 7th, I want to say, 2020. And he was basically like, you know, I'm working on this investigation. I have a lead. I want to come tell you the details. Oh, and by the way, I have these like film guys from, you know, Hollywood who want to make a movie about you. I was not a film guy from Hollywood. I was probably the furthest thing from it. Alexei didn't know that. And so he was receptive to the idea. And in the middle of COVID, we took a car across the German-Austrian border to the Black Forest, the town that is sort of depicted in the movie. And I had the opportunity to sort of pitch Navalny on the concept, really, of a film project. Here's someone, he really understood YouTube. That was his, you know, media scope. But I don't think he had a, sort of an understanding of what a movie was and the differences between, you know, cinema and YouTube. So this was like November, I want to say November 14th, 2020, when I met Alexei for the first time and when I had the opportunity to pitch him and essentially say, here's why we should do a film. And I was sort of like shitting bricks during that conversation. It was obviously intimidating. Maria Pevchik, who I don't know if you have ever encountered Maria, but she's terrifying. And she was sitting there in that meeting. And, you know, I just did my, tried to explain to Alexei with as much clarity as I could why film is different than a YouTube video and why for the purposes of this moment in his life, a film would be an incredibly valuable asset for him. So I had to sort of make it worth his while. I guess he was receptive to my pitch because we started shooting the next day. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
Right.
There's a few moments in the film where Maria is sort of asking, you have it on camera, so I don't know if maybe they are aware they're being filmed at the same time, but she's asking Navalny if he's upset with the line of questioning, if you're getting too much into the past, and if he wants her to intervene on his behalf. Like, was that the relationship that kind of progressed while you were filming, is that he seemed to be open to filming, but she would kind of monitor to make sure that everything was going according to plan?
Well, she's like the protector, right? Yeah. If there's a good cop, bad cop dynamic, she's the bad cop. He's the good cop. And he would sort of like deputize her to, if there was something, if I was like, hey, let's do this thing, you know, she would be the one to be like, absolutely fucking not. We're not doing that. He doesn't want to do that. You know, that sort of thing. But yeah, she's very much his lieutenant in sort of every sense of the term. And yeah, the tension was like, you know, you guys put in what you get out. The more access we get, the better the movie's going to be. That's a very basic arithmetic, and I tried to explain that. But, you know, at the same time, they were very busy doing other things. And, you know, I think Maria at the beginning was like, hey, wait, I make the videos around here. Who the fuck's this guy? It had that sort of sensibility. And she's a tough cookie at the best of times, right? And that's why she's so good at her job, because she is, you know, totally fearless. And like, I don't know that I've met a more effective person in the job that they do in the world than Maria Pevchik. And part of that is protecting him, right? That was sort of how she functioned during the shoot. And it was, you know, obvious to us. We were very aware of the fact that we were making a movie about a politician, not just any politician, but a politician who his great superpower is his mastery of the media, sort of. So we were like...
That and talking to anybody on the political spectrum, according to what he told you.
Yeah, that's what he would say, yeah. But for my money, from my perspective, that's how he would characterize himself. The way I would characterize him is that his great power is his ability to leverage contemporary social, internet, digital media to further his political agenda and spread his message far and wide. And so with that, the question immediately from my perspective was, how is this guy now weaponizing us? You know, this is like a game. I want to make a cool movie, and he's the sort of keys to that. And he wants me to further his political mission as well. And that tension between filmmaker and subject, me being so hyper aware that this is a guy who's playing me in a way and using me, it was such a fascinating, you know, conflict and sort of inherent tension in the filmmaking process that we decided pretty early on, let's just put that in the movie. And those scenes that you're talking about when Maria's like talking about me or referencing me without, you know, knowing that she's on mic, like the hot mic moments.
Are you standing at the camera when that's happening, or did you wander off?
Oh, I wandered off. But my prerogative was always to be like, cut, and then keep it rolling always, because, you know, you never know what you're going to get. And of course, that was a moment where they thought that it had stopped. We were done, which we had, and we were. And because the camera even rolls out, like you see the camera stop in that scene. And it's because Nikki cut the camera to DT. So yeah, that was what we call the hot mic moment. And when Maria watched it, when we showed it to her, we were all like, oh, she's going to be mad about this. She's not going to like this. But I think she sort of didn't watch it on the level of like, you know, conspiring political aide trying to exert influence over this project that they're doing. She was just like, oh, I did a, you know, that's my job. That's what I do. I did a good job, which is also true, you know, so it works on both levels.
When you went in to make this film, you noted that, you know, you're aware of Navalny trying to get the most out of you. You're trying to get the most out of him. Did you have any political ambitions of your own? Were you like fed up with Putin and you're like, I'm going to go to Navalny because he'll help me make a good movie against Putin?
No, I mean, absolutely not. I knew Putin was a dipshit.
Sure.
Right. International thug of history. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, was it like, oh yeah, I'm like drinking the Navalny Kool-Aid and this is my way to contribute to the like democratic movement in Russia? No, I was like, oh, this is, we can make a fucking great movie. He's a great character. This is a crazy situation. This is what documentary dreams are made of. That's what I'm coming to this from. And then he's like, how can I use this guy? And I'm like, how can I make it, turn him into an amazing movie? And, you know, the inherent tension in that is sort of where like the best parts of the movie shine, in my opinion.
In terms of how much he jokes,
yeah,
throughout the film, throughout his life, I mean, he's like one of the most smiley Russian people I think I've ever seen.
I just have to say, I haven't spent so much time around Russian people, but like an ice coldness, like I really freak out around them because I'm someone who's very like, open and clear. And like, if I'm feeling something, I will be like, this is how I'm feeling. This is like, that thing you said made me feel bad, or like literally an open book in every sense of that phrase. And, you know, a lot of Russian people, it's like, you have to be fucking steel-eyed. Like, that's the whole thing. Like, you know, like mobster, you can't let them know what you're thinking. Like, and so there's an energy misalignment with me and I think most Russian people. But Navalny doesn't really, as you pointed out, he's sort of different in that way. Like, he's kind of like, a little more open, I would say.
And so you're filming this guy who's joking about very serious and depressing things. And given the way the film ends, it is ultimately, ends it with a sort of sad story. And now that Navalny has died, his life ends with a sad story as well. When you're approaching this as a filmmaker, are you thinking, I'm filming a tragedy, I'm filming a comedy, like in terms of like genre tropes?
Yeah, I'm like, no, this is like a cool spy thriller movie. That's what's going through our heads. Cool spy thriller movie. Make it a thriller. That's what Navalny asks of us in the opening moment of the movie. Make it a thriller. And I wanted to make it a thriller, so I obliged him. And that's what we tried to do. That's what we were thinking about. And I think if there's one genre trope that that was close to my thoughts, it was like, you know, I wanted to feel more like James Bond or Jason Bourne than, you know, Citizen Four or something like that.
One of the scenes in the movie that really struck me as somebody who's followed Navalny's career for, I don't know, more than a decade, it feels like 20 years, but it hasn't been quite that long. But it's the scene where after they have the phone call with Kudryavtsev and they release this, maybe they haven't even released that video yet, but they're releasing a video and they're counting the views and they're,
yeah,
kind of like, they're getting giddy. And Grozev is also giddy. And I think at one point he says, oh, you're going to be president. Maybe he's joking, but it does kind of capture this energy that seizes them. And, you know, watching it, knowing that he's then arrested, he's in prison, and now certainly that he dies in prison, I watched that because I just watched the movie again, and I thought, like, man, this is delusion, or I'm not sure what it is. But when you were filming that, were you thinking these guys are misreading this? Because, I mean, part of it is like they're looking at YouTube counts, and it's like, but the Russia is still a totalitarian country, or it's certainly, you know, creeping
right.
That way.
It's like they're sitting there watching YouTube numbers and thinking like that'll have any material impact in the world. But I think that the way that scene plays is that Grozev said, geez, man, I think he'll be president. And then Navalny says, no, now they will definitely kill me. So actually, if that's how it plays, if my memory serves, then I think it's actually a lot, you know, soberly realistic than you are remembering.
He spilled the whole story. This is unbelievable.
Poor guy.
Poor guy.
They will kill him.
Literally. I think you'll be president. Seriously. After this.
They will definitely kill me.
I think Navalny is someone who understands the limitations of social media activism and doing stuff on the internet. I didn't get the impression that he thought that he would single-handedly use Facebook and Instagram or whatever and Telegram to like end the Russian, you know, this dictatorship and then embrace democracy. You know, I don't know that for sure, but he was a smart guy. He wasn't an idiot. I think he understood the political realities. And if he felt that he could really be an agent of change in the way that we sort of sometimes think from the peaks of social media land, then he probably, maybe he would have made a different decision when it comes to going back to Russia. I don't know that for sure, but It seems like an intuitive thing.
Did anybody try to talk him out of it? Because in the film, it seems like everybody in his circle either reluctantly accepts that it has to happen, or they believe that it's his duty, and they sort of parrot the reasons that he gives for the necessity of it, or he's argued elsewhere.
Yeah, I got the impression that there was like to question it seemed taboo.
Mm.
I don't know how else to put it.
Because it would be disrespectful, or because it's like superstitious?
Yeah, it's something like that. So I don't know, something like that. It was just like, you know,
honoring his decision.
Yeah, you just like, okay, we're all, he's the boss, we're falling in line, this is what he wants to do, like that type of thing maybe. I don't know that for sure, but that's just the impression that I get. I mean, certainly from people have asked me, you know, in the last couple of years, like, did you ever try and talk him out of it? It's like, you know, who the fuck was I? Like, I was some fucking idiot, like, filmmaker from Canada who doesn't speak Russian, who's never been to Russia. Like, the only Russians I know are like Vladislav Tretiak and Alexander Ovechkin, you know, as if I'm going to sit there and be like, dude, what are you doing? You're making a big mistake. Like, don't go back. It would just be, you know, sort of kind of like disrespectful and insulting and not my place. You know, he was a grown up. He was doing this with both eyes open. And who was I to try and talk him out of this. He knew what he was doing.
Did you get a sense of the life that he could have had if he'd stayed in Germany? I mean, that's kind of the sense I got when watching, you know, him going on walks and joking with...
Yeah, he would have been hanging out with the donkey and the pony. You know, that would have been his life.
After I went out of the hospital, I decided to move in the Black Forest and live in some small village. You can just walk for hours and not meet any person at all. These are my German friends. Actually, Little Pony is my friend and Donkey is Yulia's friend.
That would have been his life. I mean, he would have had a very pleasant life. I'm sure the Germans would have provided him with protection and whatever, whatever. But like, would he have been happy doing that? No, he would have been fucking miserable.
Right.
That's why he went back.
Right. Did you get the sense that he had to like turn anything on when he sat down in the chair in that bar to do the kind of serious interview versus when he's just either, you know, going for a stroll or when he's doing his research, you know, with his team?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, look, he is a politician. Of course he turns it on. He, you know, he's super charming, super charismatic. He's very good, very erudite, you know, very funny. And yeah, when we sit down to do the interview, certainly he's like, I would say he's on. But the best parts of the movie, I think, Kevin, are the parts where he like drops the act, you know, shall we say, or like that type of sensibility. Like there's a moment where he's like, that you spoke to earlier, where he and Maria are like, I'm paraphrasing, but he's like, I'm a little embarrassed or self-conscious about my English, you know, or something like that. And it's like, no, this is a guy who outwardly lets on that everything's fine, like superhuman confidence. And in the private recesses of the interview, I guess, when he doesn't think he's being filmed, that's when he's like, oh, how's my English sounding? Like that sort of thing. But I'm very aware that he's a politician. I'm very aware that him participating in this and letting us into his crazy life is a political endeavor. And I just put that in the movie. I thought it was very interesting and compelling. And I thought that, yeah, it's sort of like along with his politics, which I quasi understood, I thought that was interesting. You know, just thought it was like an interesting character. And that's how I was thinking about this.
Did you ever think about putting more of yourself in the documentary, or did like the form in which you finished it, was that kind of always the way it was going to be? Or did you have to come to a decision at some point about exactly how you're going to edit it?
You hear my voice in the movie. In fact, I think it's the first piece of media that we interact with on, you know, in the film. I didn't want to even do that. You know, that to me was like cheesy. I don't want to be in my own movie type of thing. But, you know, the relationship that he and I had was very kind of like friendly and jokey and sarcastic. And he would let me have it, you know, and take the piss out of me and I would give it right back to him. And I would say that like that dynamic was so rich and you got so much out of his character by having him like roll his eyes at me and be like, oh, Daniel, no, like, no. And tell me what kind of movie we're going to make, which sort of like sets up the meta narrative that I'm speaking about of like subject versus filmmaker, like who's in charge, which I'm so interested in. So that's why we were like, we experimented with my voice being in the movie, but you know, no more than that. I'm like, it's kind of corny when, you know, filmmakers put themselves in their movies, I think. But it works sometimes. And I think that the voice device was effective here. And actually, like the thing that Yobi might be interested to know about that motivated that creative decision was the Achilles heel, like our white whale narratively, which was Alexei's flirtation with nationalism. I think everyone asks about. And we understood with clarity that we had to put that in the movie. there's no way you can make this movie without including that. Because then you and all your colleagues would be like, this is a puff piece, fuck this, which I would understand. And so then the mission editorially is like, okay, you have to include the fact that this guy in the past has had sketchy political alignments, try and litigate that and explain that in the film, and you can't lose your audience. I mean, talking to him about it's one thing, but like, I was more concerned about like people being like, oh, this guy is an asshole, I'm turning this off. And that tightrope walk was very challenging. And we just understood that like, A, we're not going to be an apologist for his affiliations and behaviors. You know, I'm myself maintained a healthy discomfort about that aspect of his political. I think, you know, from his perspective, it was sort of like a non-issue in Russian domestic circles. And it was only, you know, the international journalists who would ask him about it nonstop. But, you know, I just knew like, you know, I can't not ask him about, you know, the Russian March stuff, right? So he was pretty game, and in a game as far, insofar as I could ask him about it, it's not as if it was off limits. But, you know, you see in the movie, the sort of like confrontational nature of me almost like being like, dude, you want to apologize? He's like, no, I am a politician who's trying to, you know, get rid of this regime. And the way that I have to do that is by teaming up with anyone who's against Putin, even if they're bad dudes, who I normally wouldn't be affiliated with. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. And, you know, my reaction to that is like, I understand, that makes me uncomfortable, you know?
Yeah. And you have footage of him actually speaking at the event too. Did the subject of Ukraine ever come up? Because now, you know, in his passing, one of the reactions that I've seen from quite a few people, given that, you know, now Russia's at a full-scale war with Ukraine, which was not the case when you were conducting the interview, obviously, but he had made comments about Crimea because obviously that had been annexed for several years already.
Our conversations about Ukraine were not political. They were about his love for Ukraine, I would say. And, you know, having spent every summer just outside of Chernobyl as a boy growing up and having a very, you know, he's half Ukrainian. So what I understood to be very clear was that he like had a sort of profound admiration for Ukraine, the country, the people. That was the extent of it. That obviously the war hadn't started yet. Maybe it would have been more of a point of discussion, but the impression that I got, I was like, oh, this guy, he really like has a deep love for this place.
When you're making the film, you know, by the time you release it, you know he's in prison and you know what likely awaits him, but you don't know for sure. But now he's died. If you were releasing the film, or if you were still editing it, let's say, you have all that footage, but let's say he dies in prison while you're doing that, would you change anything about how you made that film, or would you keep it exactly as it was?
You know, the film's already different. It airs on CNN when the film finishes, and Navalny smiles and sort of walks off. It says, you know, Alexei Navalny, what is it?
1976
to, you know, 2024. The answer to that is yes. The how, I don't know. Yeah, it would be different. I don't know how it would be different is the answer to that question.
Julie Yoffe's articles have appeared in so many prominent publications that my eyes roll back into my head and my brain explodes a little bit when I look at her resume. She's also a regular expert on television news programs, and she serves as the Washington correspondent for PUC. Julia is also responsible for some of the earliest and most influential reporting on Navalny and his associates, including his wife, profiling them both in stories for The New Yorker and Vanity Fair, in articles that came out roughly a decade apart. She has a book due out on March 4th, 2025, in about 11 months, titled Motherland, A Feminist History of Modern Russia from Revolution to Autocracy, that you can already pre-order on Amazon, and hopefully I'll get her back on this podcast to talk about that. But this week, she joins the Naked Pravda to talk about the Navalnys. So the first question was, I wanted to know if you remember the first time you heard of him, the first time you met him. Like, what were your earliest impressions that come to mind?
I remember the first time I met Navalny really, really well. It was late fall, early winter of 2010. And I had noticed his kind of live journal going around more. And I thought, you know, I was a freelancer at the time, and I thought this will make an interesting blog post for Forbes or Fortune. I was writing for both of them, and I always got them confused. And I set up a lunch with him, and I remember I had a horrible cold, and I was like just super foggy and snotty. And I showed up, and it was near Pavelétskaya. And I showed up, and within like 30 seconds, I was like, holy shit, this is something else. This is not a short, like a blog post about a blogger, because the days of blogs, right? I was like, this is something qualitatively different. And even through my snotty haze, his charisma, his intensity just cut through so sharply. And I just remember thinking like, oh, this is what it must have been like to be around a young, you know, Bill Clinton right after law school, or, you know, a young Boris Yeltsin or a young Nelson Mandela, like that kind of that intense force of personality, the charisma, the like, you know, it sounds cliche, but like, you know, somebody who sucks all the air out of the room in a good way. And I had lunch with him. And as I'm talking, I was like, this is something much bigger. And I went home and wrote an email to David Remnick and was like, hey, I think we should write a profile of this guy. He's a blogger, but, you know, let me explain. And that's how that New Yorker profile came about. But I will never forget that first meeting. It made a massive impression on me. And I remember something that Masha Lipman said to me at the time when I interviewed her for the piece that has stuck in my head ever since. And she said, you know, if this were a real country with real politics, Navalny would have a brilliant political future.
In a profile published in The New Yorker in June 2012, Julie described Navalny as typically cheery and sarcastic, saying that he cultivated the image of a fighter for truth who fears nothing. Here's how that story begins.
At around 7 a.m. on Monday morning, someone rang the door at the Moscow flat of opposition politician Alexei Navalny. Navalny and his wife were sound asleep. It was a long holiday weekend celebrating the day in 1990 when Russia declared its independence from the Soviet Union. So Navalny and his wife kept sleeping, but the doorbell kept ringing. Finally, Julia, his wife, got up to check who was there. She looked through the peephole and saw seven men in uniform. I thought it was either an arrest or a search, so I turned off the lights, as one does in such situations, and called my lawyer, Navalny told me later. Then he went to shave, because you never know when your next shave will be if they arrest you.
This idea of, like, if Russia were a normal country, then, like, this person doing this would be doing this other thing. So it's kind of like an interesting thought experiment. It's like the alternate universe. It's like, what would I be doing in an alternate universe?
You know, it can be a little bit of, you know, to quote Putin's favorite expression of grandma had balls, she'd be grandpa. But and I've been thinking about it a lot since Navalny's death, which is still a very weird thing to say and to think. I still haven't fully grasped it, I feel. But I've thought about that often. And I've also thought about how the balance between kind of Navalny's best and worst traits, and the way one of his best traits, I feel, was his willingness to learn and his recognition of, you know, after some bluster and some pushback and some insulting of the questioner, he did do a lot of reading, a lot of soul searching, a lot of thinking, debating with people he was close to. His positions on things did evolve, which is a rarity for quote unquote real politicians. Like, you don't see a lot of that here in Washington. You know, people, you don't want to be a flip-flopper. You want to be consistent, especially in the ages of Trump and Putin. Admitting you're wrong is seen as a sign of weakness. And I wonder if Navalny ever got real power, you know, if he had become mayor of Moscow in 2013. Or if Russia had gone in a different direction after Bolotnaya, if he would have maintained that kind of flexibility and self-awareness and capacity for self-criticism and evolution. You know, in some ways, it was a luxury of not being in power, that you have the time and the, you know, your views on, like, the Russian tax code can evolve as much as they want, because they don't matter, right, if you're never in power.
Navalny was always kind of, I mean, dismissive is maybe not the right word, but he was always immediately exhausted, it seemed, when especially foreign journalists and documentarians would ask him about his nationalism. and then maybe later in his career a bit about Ukraine, but he was imprisoned before the full-scale war, so that didn't come to the foreground as much, although people definitely remember him saying, you know, comparing Crimea to a sandwich and using some slurs and so on.
Though his views on the latter, on Ukraine, evolved, right? You know, he released, if you recall, he released that program of what he thought should happen vis-a-vis Ukraine, you know, a return to 1991 borders, paying reparations to Ukraine, things like that, that I think are the only morally right positions to take.
A few days before the anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Navalny penned 15 theses from prison, revising and outlining his political platform. In that document, he argued that Putin was trying but failing to turn Russians into his accomplices in an unjust war, insisting that Russians are not inherently imperialistic. Navalny acknowledged the murder of tens of thousands of innocent Ukrainians and said Russia was losing militarily. He also endorsed Ukraine's 1991 borders, effectively declaring Crimea to be Ukrainian, which is something he resisted advocating in the years before, saying that the territory isn't a sandwich to be passed around. Navalny also supported reparations for Ukraine and war crimes prosecutions against Russian officials.
And which Ukrainians have never accepted, although from where I sit, I feel like they're never going to get a Russian president with views better than that.
Right.
And they're not going to get ever going to get a Russian president with views anything remotely approaching that. On the nationalism thing, speaking to a really good friend of mine who is Chechen, we were talking about exactly that. And she noted that, curiously on that, he never really finished his evolution. She was like, I really wanted to like him. I really wanted to throw my support fully behind him if he were just more clear. But what he said instead was always, like you said, very dismissive, very angry, eye rolling, kind of, I've already said that. Go back and look at my past interviews. I'm not going to say it again. But then you go back to his previous interviews and he was always saying that, right? So it was like, so what is the thing that you're referring back to?
Do you think his audience, the people he was trying to win over, were always the same? Or did he try appealing to different groups? Because maybe it was a cynical impression I have at some moments is that as his team was sort of forced into exile, he gradually, and certainly after he was imprisoned, his audience became less the people in Russia and more kind of like a global audience. And that necessitated different language. But maybe that's a bad reading. I don't know. How do you see it?
The way I saw it was that pre-Bolotna, when protests up around kind of liberal democratic themes would draw a couple hundred people max, you know, half of whom would be babushki, шестидесятники. It was very clear looking at that that's not, you know, nobody could build a political future off of that. At the time, the only real, like really organized position anyway were the Russian nationalists, and they would have that Russian march through Moscow every year, and it seemed like that was a clear path to power, and there was a sense of like they're Russian too and somebody has to talk to them. It might as well be me. And also I don't know that those views expressed at the Russian march were that far from him, from what he truly believed. I think some of the more extreme things, probably, yeah. But what I tried to explain to Americans who are like, oh, he's so racist, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, have you ever met liberal Russians, liberal Moscovites? Like, they're quite racist. They're not less racist than those Navalny videos. You know what I mean? As Arseniy Bobrovsky, who still runs the Kremlin Russia account, which is like really dating my Russian knowledge or my time in Russia, we would always joke together that the best Russian liberals were too right-wing for Fox News. But yeah, I think when Bolotna happened, it showed Navalny that there was a different route to power potentially, and a different constituency that he could speak to that wanted to hear from him, a bigger one than the Russian march provided.
Both like with nationalism and now Ukraine, these are like the two issues that certainly sprung up a lot in the wake of his death. A lot of people who wanted to downplay it because they saw that as like a, obviously it looks bad for the Putin regime. And so anybody who's inclined to defend the Putin regime is going to look for a way to criticize Navalny. And it was nationalism and Ukraine comments that came up a lot. These issues are not super, maybe Ukraine is a bit, but like the nationalism thing always struck me as something that was, you know, it was a worthwhile thing to discuss, and it was very provocative, interesting to foreign observers, but it was never such a, it didn't seem like such a huge liability for Navalny domestically.
Yeah, that's what I mean, is that Russian liberals don't necessarily disagree with a lot of those views. And, you know, it's what Ukrainians point out. It's what Russians who are not from the kind of ethnic Russian majority point out.
Even in Russia, though, he was never prosecuted. Or maybe there might have been an occasion or two where something he said nationalistically was like involved in one of the prosecutions against him. But the propaganda against him domestically, as I understand it, doesn't typically have to do with nationalism.
No, it wasn't really. Right. That's right. That's a really good point. It was all that he is a zhulyak, mashenik, that he's, you know, a thief. And basically the same things he used to say about United Russia, that they were crooks and swindlers, they would say about Navalny. The one thing I would push back on, again, and it's kind of it depends who you talk to. If you talk to Russians who are from the kind of the majority ethnos, and I think I would even put kind of Moscow's like Jewish intelligentsia as part of that, who is quite, to use a charged word, deracinated, like it didn't bother them.
Well, why don't I shift to Yulia Navalnaya? I find it a little difficult to broach the subject just because she's in mourning still. She's a widow. But at the same time, she's presenting herself and Team Navalny is presenting her as this sort of next generation or replacement opposition figure, leader. So in that regard, I suppose it's fair to talk about her and her potential, you know, as an opposition figure. Do you think that she has potential as an opposition figure, or is she just...
Well, I don't know what an opposition figure can do right now. Like, what is an opposition figure when so much of the opposition is outside of Russia, scattered, you know, to the four corners of the world, and whoever's left in Russia is scared to make a peep because people are sent to jail for the kinds of earrings they wear and what kind of colors happen to be on their shirt and their user pic on WhatsApp, right? I mean, on one hand, yes, Yulia was the kind of, in this kind of classic, not quite feminist fashion, you know, where like the figurehead and the leader is still the president, but his closest advisor is his wife, you know, kind of like Gorbachev and Raisa, or, you know, Joe Biden and Jill Biden, you know, like, of course, she's his closest advisor. She's there for a lot of it. She has been there for all of it. She's, from what I understand, she kept a careful distance from the Anti-Corruption Foundation and the daily work, but she was read into a lot of it.
You compared it to Nadezhda Krupskaya in your Vanity Fair piece.
Yeah, yeah.
For listeners who aren't familiar with like her significance, like what does that bring to this comparison that something like comparing her to Michelle Obama doesn't?
So the Krupskaya comparison came out of the book I'm working on, which comes out next March, and it's called Motherland, and you can pre-order it on Amazon. Basically, Krupskaya, Lenin's wife, was always relegated to just, you know, oh, she was just his ugly wife with a weird thyroid condition. But she was a real revolutionary, and she enabled a lot of the work that Lenin did himself. Like, a lot of the political writing and translations that he did, they did together. She actually, much more than Yulia, Krupskaya actually, when Lenin was in exile, Krupskaya was the kind of the bureaucratic machinery of the party. And Trotsky describes the office where she worked, because she was the one who kept track of everybody's aliases, everybody's addresses, which were constantly shifting and moving because they were all underground agents. And he recalled that her office always smelled like burning paper because she was developing burning paper to develop invisible ink. So she kept track. She sat atop this like web of correspondences of Bolshevik agents across Europe and embedded in Russia. And she was kind of the bureaucratic nerve center of the revolution while they were in exile, especially, and wrote things in her own right, was a revolutionary thinker in her own right. But she never really kind of got the credit because she was always the, you know, the wife in the background. She's also a lot like, what I didn't mention in the piece, she's a lot like Raisa Gorbachova, who I would say is probably the closer analogy, as very much the wife, very feminine. You know, Krupskaya really hated wearing, you know, fancy clothes, and not that Yulia does, but like she, like a lot of Bolshevik revolutionary women, you know, specifically dressed ugly. Whereas Raisa, you know, took care of her appearance. No, not that that's a bad thing. You know, like Yulia, she always looked good. She was Gorbachev's closest advisor. You know, she helped read the speeches, write the speeches. You know, the famous Perestroika speech that Gorbachev gave at the beginning of his premiership. Raisa was one of the consultants and writers on that.
One of the other things from that Vanity Fair piece that I got was that there are two sides. Well, I'm sure there's many sides to Yulia, but that two of the sides are that she's capable of this sort of like infinite, or at least self-expressed infinite Christian forgiveness. Like she doesn't even want to harm Kudryavtsev, this guy who helped poison Navalny, her husband. And then there's also insights that she's perhaps, you know, part of the reason that Navalny has these long-going, you know, fights with other members of the opposition. And actually, just like in the last few weeks, when they were still debating to get Navalny's body released, this Boris Nadezhdin character, who was like maybe going to be a opposition presidential candidate, he tweeted something like, you know, just release the body. Doesn't matter how you feel about Alexei Navalny, but like his body should be released. And she tweeted back, or quote tweeted him or whatever, quote posted him, and said, I won't give you the right to be ambiguous about how you feel about my husband. Like, I won't give anyone that right. And it, to me, it was like, oh, this is like very much in the spirit of Alexei. It's like, you know, this like no room for moral ambiguity, kind of like you follow me. I have the right take here. And I wondered, without Alexei heading the movement, even sort of, I mean, I guess spiritually he still heads it. And when he was behind bars, he wasn't actually running it, but he was still present and it kind of gave the whole team gravitas. Like now, I wonder, and I'm interested what you think, do you think it requires like that same steady kind of like do it this way, the opposition is always fighting itself, like someone needs to just take the reins and go, or is there like more need now to be kind of accommodating?
I mean, what I kept thinking when we learned of Navalny's death, which again sounds completely wild still, I remember everybody playing that clip from Daniel Rohr's documentary where he says, you can't stop fighting, you got to keep fighting. And I just kept thinking like, well, how are they going to do that? Because they're not very good at fighting. I mean, they've been, the Russian opposition has been decapitated several times. You know, I mean, that was always the thing that struck me about Navalny, is that he fought smarter than everybody else, more than Nemtsov, more than any of the other kind of figureheads from 2012 and since that have kind of disappeared. I remember whenever there were, used to be, when there were more leaders and there were more debates about, you know, what to do with this in the 2012 election or the 2018 election or this election, like what's the strategy going to be? He always came up with the best idea. I don't know how much of that was his team. I have a feeling a lot of that was him. He was just really, really good, both strategically and tactically at thinking of this stuff. And the other people would come up with weird, gimmicky, kind of classically lame Russian opposition stuff. And it struck me that you could see the fall off immediately with the Boldin protiv Putina action. And I wrote about it at the time. Like, it wasn't originally Navalny's idea. He said, okay, sure, do this from prison. But it was a weird idea. How can anybody tell who you're here to vote for? You know, are the lines the chinovniki who had to bring 10 people each? As we know from Medusa's reporting, is it people coming to vote for one of the other no-name candidates or for Putin himself? And then the other thing was the show of force that it showed outside of, like, I feel like the biggest crowds were outside of Russia, which, as I wrote at the time, if I were Putin seeing all this, I was like, I would be so happy that these tens of thousands of people who are so happy to come out and vote against me are doing so in Tel Aviv and Berlin and London and New York and wherever. It's just kind of the perfect embodiment of Putin's success in the war and the fact that he drove out pretty much everybody who disagrees with him and was willing to do anything about it. So I thought like that first, the very first action that the opposition undertook after Navalny's death was, I think, kind of a failure.
Do you think that decades from now, when retelling this last decade of Russian history, Navalny will figure big, or will it'll kind of fade because it didn't lead anywhere?
It's a really good question, and then the first night that it was Friday night that we, you know, after learning about Navalny's death, I was at the Munich Security Conference and I ran into Mike McFaul, who was very close to the Navalny's, in part because their daughter Dasha is at Stanford where he still teaches. And Dasha was apparently, when I ran into him, you know, he had just gotten off the phone with his wife and Dasha was on her way over to their house, you know, and he was in tears himself. And he was talking about how in his revolutions class, he would always teach, you know, how for every Nelson Mandela, there were, you know, 10 others who died in prison or were executed, who never got to get out of the prison gates and become president and lead the resistance into kind of legitimate government. He was like, I never thought Navalny would be in that latter category, but unfortunately he is. You know, I think it was like around that time I started realizing how much Navalny's optimism had infected me and so many others, right? That he would, of course, he'd come out the prison gates and become a Mandela. Like that was the template, right? And of course, he would outlive Putin. He was younger and sturdier. But what you realize now, you know, in retrospect, is the Mandela story is a story and one to which we continue referring decades later is because it's so exceptional. And it's also the exception that proves the rule, right? That it's very hard to topple repressive dictatorships. It's very hard to go from revolutionary to peacemaker to national level unifier. It's nearly impossible. And to your question, I don't know. I don't know if, I think it also depends what happens in the future in Russia. If, you know, Navalny is a kind of like Nechayev character, you know, somebody who was a revolutionary that didn't get to see the revolution come to fruition, but inspires later generations of revolutionaries. You know, you have to, when you learn about the Russian Revolution in any real way, you have to learn about these people who didn't get to see it happen, right? The Sofia Perovskas who were hung and all the other people who didn't get to live to see it happen. So I wonder if he will be one of those people, one of the kind of spiritual forefathers of any future Russian Revolution.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.